So you each shared what area of interest you have, but I want to also understand what you're looking for in your pipeline for this year, next year, what your future thoughts are on growth. Michael G, what are you actively looking for in sourcing today?
So I've been looking at a lot of, like Rachel was saying earlier today and a little bit yesterday, top line lending against people's top line revenue, and then getting a piece of their company on exit after we 2 to 3x our money that goes in. I'm also excited about the motel to apartment conversion project that they're working on. We're going to go take a look at that in a couple days in Houston. And those are the sort of things I'm sourcing right now for myself.
Great. Nick, you mentioned industrial specifically, correct?
Well, that's something we do focus on, but primarily right now we are looking for multifamily projects that are in distress, not necessarily in bad shape, but in financial distress. We see a lot of these multifamily projects that were picked up in very low cap rates that cannot refinance now, and that's a prime ground to look at some of these developments where you're buying them, way below construction cost. We're also looking at the debt markets. We're active there, where we're picking up notes that banks don't want. Signature Bank, that went under in the springtime, is selling their note packages now through Newmark. So you're having a lot of cross currents in the marketplace, because no one really knows when rates will go down. But at the same time, there's definitely assets out there that are interesting, not just office, that are in distress, and this is what we do. We haven't made a ground up development in a few years, only because it doesn't make sense when you can pick up a live asset, so to speak, without all the grunt work. My partner always says there's no glory in building, especially if you're going super vertical. So right now, if you have the opportunity to pick up assets that are in distress, so it could be rescue capital, it could be stalled projects, projects that are just don't have enough capital, people don't have enough money for a capital call. Those are the deals we're looking at. And if you have those type of deals, we'd like to talk to you.
We're very similar. I'm an opportunistic investor. So we look for situations where there's a financial challenge with the multifamily property, pre-foreclosure. People are getting older. They want to retire. They want to move out of state. And so, but there's some weakness, not so much in a property, but the individuals that own it, partners that fight. And I was taught for the last 20 years with my mentors to focus on buying right, not buying often. So we do buy in multiple states. We're in California, Washington, Florida is incredible what's going on over there. And so what I'm really here for is putting out the message. If you are in the industry of multifamily, you're a broker, you may know someone, we buy with cash, we can wrap around the deals. We love passive income. So I know we're going into a challenging time. I like to model our business kind of Blackstone. They buy a lot, and we buy below replacement costs. So I know a lot of people may not like to hear that, but it makes a lot of money, and it does really well. You don't lose money, so that's why we like it a lot. Thank you.
So for myself personally, we're looking at some multifamily 1031 exchange right now. We like multifamily. We tend to like things that are a little niche-y. Historic is nice for us because we think it attracts better quality of tenant. We too are opportunistic, but not predatory investors. There's a difference. And just really, we're very open-minded in our group. We've done some great deals. One of the deals that we did that was a little venture debt-y, was something that myself and some of the other members had invested in at an equity level. So we had preferred stock. Company was in a cash situation. They borrowed some money, and we ended up doing very well out of that because that helped bridge them to an acquisition. So not only did we make money on the debt, we also were able to protect our original investment and make money on the equity sale. So we look at these very holistically as a group. Because that's what angel groups are there for, right? If you don't fit in the regular models that there are real professional slots for, you come to an angel group.
So, at Emigrant Partners, so we're not real estate at all, so definitely differentiated there. We are looking for private equity sponsors, asset managers, multifamily offices, independent wealth management firms who would be interested in receiving some minority capital and a strategic advice partnership. All of our deals are minority. We do not take board seats. We're very careful not to cross into a realm of being considered to have any control right. Of course, our documents do have, you know, covenants and and consent requirements for a number of matters. We're also, so our portfolio has been financed almost entirely through balance sheet money of Emigrant Bank, and Emigrant Bank is owned by a large family office. We have, we would be interested in partnering with other groups in co-investments in some of our deals, some of our bigger deals, and or potentially in a slice of our portfolio.
What we're looking for are landlord-friendly cities only, which is mostly the Sun Belt. We're looking for blood in the water. There has to be massive upside in the best locations. And if it doesn't meet that criteria, if one of those things are off, we won't buy. We're going to be extremely conservative. I've been doing this since 83, and I've never seen what I've seen in the last 12 to 18 months, which is good, because I think there's going to be more opportunity now in the next 3 to 5 years than perhaps any time in my career. And so I'm looking for people that are looking for what I'm looking for, which again is great opportunity, but only in the best cities where, as landlords, we are welcomed. That's incredibly important. And there's massive migration coming to those cities. And then in that city, it has to be the best location, plenty of traffic. I'm not looking for A. We're looking to buy C to go to B, or maybe B, but not necessarily go to A. We just want to jack the rents up as high as possible. And that's pretty much it.
Fantastic. Thank you. Jamie, you're kind of the unique one here with what you what you're looking for. When you're talking about your structures, is there something that stands out to you? Are there unique structures that you're looking for or that you tend to lean towards more? Something that stands out? Jamie?
Talking to me?
Jamie. Jamie. Yeah. You're the unique one, right? You're okay.
So, well, okay, so our deals are structured in an interesting way. It's really a hybrid debt equity instrument. It's participating debt. Basically, we receive a we receive a coupon that has a fixed interest rate attached to it, and then to the extent that it would result in a larger number, we receive a share of the adjusted EBITDA of the firms that we invest in. Similarly, when we ultimately exit our deals, and our deals are very long term, you know, 20, 30 plus years. Although some firms, you know, have a sale event or, you know, and usually we'll work with them on an earlier exit. But at the repayment of our debt at the end of the term is basically the fair market value of an equivalent percentage of equity. So In essence, we're getting the upside of equity and the downside protection of a coupon and being high in the capital stack with a secured interest as a lender.
Right. Does anyone else on the panel have, from a real estate perspective, have a type of structure that you look for, that you lean towards specifically? No? So anyone can send anything, and you're good?
Yes, actually.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
So when we model a property, we're analyzing a property, we want to make sure we always want to assume the worst. We want to stress test it extremely hard, which has really helped us the last 12 to 18 months, because unfortunately, some of the people that I've watched, they tried to buy the most amount of property with the least amount down. And while I like leverage, we not only had no problem putting down 30 to 40%, but we also assumed, God forbid, that we would have occupancy vacancy up to 30%. And of course, we've never had that, but our buildings, our properties, our portfolio will still perform even under the worst circumstances. And that's been very, very helpful to us. We're very conservative. We'd rather buy less, but have it really perform great for myself and for our investors. And I think it also is best for our tenants, which is the people we're serving. I mean, it's really a great honor to be a landlord, right? I mean, it's one of the highest honors you can have, because you're going into an area and you're improving it. And you want to do everything you can to make that community great for the moms and the kids and all that stuff. And that's really important to us. So why does that matter to what I'm saying? Because they can sleep at night because we don't have to stress about the property. And we can give that property what it needs from day one.
Great. Che, you and I had some conversations when you first arrived today about San Francisco specifically, but about your knowledge in the area of debt and structures.
First thing I want to do is compliment Michael for having that more enlightened point of view, because we too consider the your tenants are your customers, right? And you know, you want your good salt of the earth people. You don't want to drive their rents up so high that you have transient people, and you don't want to have them so low that you can't fix the place and then you end up in a slumlord situation. But reframing, a lot of folks don't seem to think of tenants as customers, right? What Holly and I were talking about, and I think New York will have a interesting thing. You know, right now, cell phone traffic in San Francisco is 29% of what it was in 2019 in downtown. The fact that there's not a traffic jam in front of this building right now on a Friday afternoon is still shocking to me as somebody who's been here for decades. So I know San Francisco's got a whole bunch of weird stuff about it. I know more about it than a lot of folks. But what's going on in Manhattan now is we move to a, you know, it's made the Wall Street Journal, and you know, every week there's a new doom cycle going on in San Francisco. We sold it was a $500 million or $300 million office building for $80 million a couple months ago. What's going on in Manhattan?
We're seeing the same thing, especially in office. You have companies like Blackstone and Brookfield that they have the capital to afford to stay in these buildings. They're giving the keys back. So you're seeing a lot of issues with office. At the same time, if you go to newer buildings like on Vanderbilt Avenue, brand new buildings, completely sold out at $250 a foot. Right?
Office.
Yeah. Right. The lower floors are in the hundreds, which you don't really see that much anymore. But it just shows that there is demand if you're putting out a premium product, you know, in the middle of Midtown Manhattan. If you have a Class C building and you don't know how to get tenants in there, you're having a really tough time. You're having an extremely tough time. And, you know, a lot of things get thrown out there, like let's convert it to residential. It's not so easy. Right, converting, if anyone understands construction, trying to convert an office building with 20-foot windows to residential to comply with the DOB is not a simple feat, right? And how do you do that the right way? And I was talking to one developer that's been doing this since the early 1990s. He said, I'm just going to demo the building, right? I'm just going to demo the building and really start from scratch. So your basis on buying the land has to be so low. We're talking about Manhattan. It still has value. Right, compared to other cities, there is office demand. Like if you go to Miami, right in Brickell, they're getting $150 a foot in the Microsoft, where they took I think 300,000 to 400,000 square feet, sold out. Right, so there are people there that are going to the office. It's hard to get people to come to the office in cities like New York, like San Francisco, where politics have made it you know difficult for the average worker to say, you know what, I'm going back to work. I'm going to take public transportation. Why? Why should I put myself at risk? And that's creating a mega shift, you know, in the real estate market for some of these assets.
I will also tell you something that's funny that happened to me this week. You know, I went up to, we have property up in Geyserville that I grew up on. I have more reliable internet in Geyserville now via Starlink than I do in downtown San Francisco, because the tech center that this place is, we can't have decent internet inexplicably.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. We haven't talked about gross revenue royalties yet. Has anyone on this panel used gross revenue royalties at all in structures?
We've tried, and there are some groups out there that are doing it professionally and all that kind of stuff. I'm more involved in hardware. It never seems to work in hardware. It's very much of a SaaS plus historics and all that kind of stuff, where you know you have a certain amount of churn, you have a certain amount of ARR, and it's literally bankable. But we have tried, we've asked, we've told people we're interested in doing this, and we've just never been able to get a deal done so far.
Michael G., it looks like you were... No? Nobody else then has anybody attempted this gross revenue royalties or considering it?
So we in our deals, I mean, we've done... so we call... You know, so typically I was saying we would take a percentage of adjusted EBITDA, and we call that supplemental interest. In one case, we based our supplemental interest on a percentage of gross revenues as opposed to adjusted EBITDA, and that was mainly just because the accounting, where the company was coming from and the way their accounting had been done, it just made more sense. It didn't really affect our relationship in a significant way. I think we would typically still prefer to take a share of adjusted EBITDA, but we would be we'd be open to a revenue percentage. I mean, it's been nice to really not have to worry to any great degree about the expenses and CapEx of a firm if we're getting a share of revenues. But the sort of partnership that we look for with our partner firms works better typically with a percentage of EBITDA.
Perfect. Does anybody have any questions on the gross? Oh, perfect.
No, about the gross. But
oh.
This is a question for the panel about debt.
Sorry, Charlie, right here.
Sorry, thank you.
Nick mentioned this earlier, but is anyone buying debt directly from banks and lenders? Is it too early, other than the banks that have failed? You mentioned Newmark selling out Signature, but is anyone in the market to buy debt loan to own for assets?
Are you talking about performing debt or non-performing?
Really, doesn't matter either way. I mean, to me, non-performing is more attractive. You can get a discount on it, but I'm more interested in buying the loans to potentially own the real estate if you're comfortable with it, or just to get performance on the debt if it comes back.
I think as an income strategy, you know, private credit has really come to the spotlight in the last 12 months, where a lot of banks are not lending and you've got private credit with much higher yields. Right now, if you're looking for a bridge debt for a multifamily deal, you're paying double digits. Right, and that's very attractive yield when you're first lien position. During the heyday of 21, where people were getting, you know, in the 80s LTVs, now you're 65 LTV. You got to bring more equity to the table, 60 LTV. I think it's a great strategy if you're looking for income and you've got some downside protection on the asset. If you're more opportunistic and you're looking to get your, you know, a little bit more hairier, get your hands dirty, I think the non-performing space is really where it is right now, where you can get default interest in some of these states where New York goes as high as 24. That's a tremendous return if you're buying the note at a discount and you have the legal know-how how to foreclose if you need to, or re-perform the asset, or try to do a deed in lieu. There's a lot of strategies, legal strategies, that can be done. That's just a little bit more, you know, a little more legwork. But getting back to your initial question, I think private credit's great.
Does anyone have a very unique structure when it comes to debt and income opportunities or structures that you would advise against or advise for? Share with the audience.
For example, if you're underwriting debt, and you're underwriting, you're looking to lend out capital to a real estate operator. Everyone has, you know, certain provisions like a confession of judgment, your personal guaranteeing, but there's different scenarios where you can cross collateralize someone's asset. There's more protection on the downside for you as a lender. And it's been tighter right now for people to borrow. So I've seen structures where someone really needed the money, and another lender just said, "Well, you're going to put your wife, on the personal guarantee." And you have, as a lender now, more leeway. You can do different things to protect your downside. Before, when money was a little bit more free, and bridge debt was in the sevens, right, 7-8%. Now you go to any branch bank, you're looking at a 30-year loan in the sevens or even eights, depending on your credit. So it's a different world, and you can be protect your downside by putting some certain scenarios in there. I was talking to someone here actually, where in Texas, you're allowed to do a deal where the deed is an escrow. So if you default, there is no foreclosure. Hmm. So it's just incredible. I mean, most states will throw that out the window, including New York, California as well. But there are some states that are super landlord friendly and owner friendly. And if you default, I mean, it's over.
Yeah. Does anybody else have any comments on this topic?
Years ago, we did non-performing notes, and most recently, I'm starting to get inquiries from people having those opportunities, more so in the private lending, hard money lending world. So I think it's a trend, and we're looking forward to doing that and doing many of the options of the in lieu of foreclosure or foreclosing on ourselves or of them, or working it out. So if you have any interest in that or you have any deal flow in that area, I'd love to talk to you. Thank you.
Talk to me first.
And do a deal with me.
I would just say that until Jay Powell crashes the economy or unemployment hits 5%, stay away from floating debt.
All right. Do we have any other audience questions at this time? Right here in the center. Awesome. Thank you, John.
I wanted to ask about the interest rate and if you guys think there is a more interest hike, or what's the relationship between that and U.S. dollar is not the world currency anymore compared to euro or any other currency that other countries like the block countries are trying to unite and remove the U.S. dollar from the world currency. Thank you.
I don't think
so. Two questions on that I heard at least was, where do we think interest rates are going? We have no special cabal information up here. We read the journal just like everybody else, right? And I think you had your own mic drop comments on that, Mike.
I've never seen this in 40 years. Until unemployment really starts ratcheting up to 4 or 5%, or until gas starts to fall, housing starts to fall, neither of which I see anytime soon, food still going to be expensive, all these things. I don't know if you guys know this, but about 10 years ago they took out of the CPI energy, food, and housing. So what you see is the CPI. These are not real numbers. These are all totally cooked, because the only thing that matters in the CPI is energy, food, and housing. And as long as they don't have to show that and they can lie about that, then you can say whatever you want. So I would just be extremely careful with debt until you see some real pain in the economy, which I don't see that yet. Maybe do you guys see any real pain in the economy yet? I don't.
Unemployment is still very low, and people do have... There's not as much competition for talent as it was maybe 18 months ago. But still, there's inflation. Wages are still very high. Inflation in general is high. Crude oil just hit a 52-week high. So you have all these things happening. And while the economy is evidently slowing down, inflation is still there. And if you're the Fed, you're looking at it and you're like, all right, what do we do here? If we keep on raising, we're going to really tank the economy. But the economy has, in my opinion, come down slightly, right? You've got, there was a great article in the journal, I think, that AI, the word AI, and companies like Nvidia have rekindled the NASDAQ, and in general, tech spending, we would have been even worse. So it's just amazing how things are happening in the marketplace and something else is taking its place.
So when I started, interest rates were at 18%. But they didn't go from 7% to 18% in 12 months.
Right.
That's the difference of what just has happened now.
Agreed. The velocity of this move is just tremendous.
Never seen before.
Yeah.
Great. It sounds like we could go on that topic for a while. So we'll go ahead and conclude there. But thank you all for being here. If we can give our panelists a round of applause. It was great speaking with you today.
Thank you.